30. It's Hodges behind the wheel of Holly's Mercedes. He obeys the traffic signals and doesn't weave wildly from lane to lane, but he makes the best time he can. He isn't a bit surprised that this run from the north side to the Halliday Bookshop on Lacemaker Lane brings back memories of a much wilder ride in the same car. It had been Jerome at the wheel that night. "How sure are you that Tina's brother went to this Halliday guy?" Jerome asks. "He's in the back this afternoon."
"He did,"
Holly says without looking up from her iPad, which she has taken from the Benz's capacious glove compartment.
"I know he did, and I think I know why. It wasn't any signed book either." She taps at the screen and mutters, "Come on, come on, come on. Load, you bugger."
"What are you looking for, Holly Berry?" Jerome asks, leaning forward between the seats.
She turns to glare at him. "Don't call me that. You know I hate that."
"Sorry, sorry." Jerome rolls his eyes.
"Tell you in a minute," she says. "I've almost got it. I just wish I had some Wi-Fi instead of this buggery cell connection. It's so slow and poopy."
Hodges laughs. He can't help it. This time Holly turns her glare on him, punching away at the screen even as she does so. Hodges climbs a ramp and merges onto the crosstown connector. "It's starting to fit together," he tells Jerome. "Assuming the book Pete talked about to Ricker was actually a writer's notebook, the one Tina saw, the one Pete was so anxious to hide under his pillow."
"Oh, it was," Holly says without looking up from her iPad. "Holly Gibney says that's a big tin four."
She punches something else in, swipes the screen, and gives a cry of frustration that makes both of her companions jump.
"Oh, these goddamn pop-up ads make me so fracking crazy."
"Calm down," Hodges tells her.
She ignores him. "You wait. You wait and see."
"The money and the notebook were a package deal," Jerome says. "The Sauber's kid found them together. That's what you think, right?" "Yeah," Hodges says. "And whatever was in the notebook was worth more money. Except a reputable rare book dealer wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole."
"Got it!"
Holly screams, making them both jump. The Mercedes swerves. The guy in the next lane honks irritably and makes an unmistakable hand gesture.
"Got what?" Jerome asks.
"Not what, Jerome. Who? John fracking Rothstein. Murdered in 1978. At least three men broke into his farmhouse, in New Hampshire this was, and killed him. They also broke into his safe. Listen to this. It's from the Manchester Union Leader 3 days after he was killed."
As she reads, Hodges exits the crosstown onto Lower Main.
"There is growing certainty that the robbers were after more than money. They may also have taken a number of notebooks containing various writings Mr. Rothstein did after retiring from public life," a source close to the investigation said. The source went on to speculate that the notebooks, whose existence was confirmed late yesterday by John Rothstein's housekeeper, might be worth a great deal on the black market."
Holly's eyes are blazing. She is having one of those divine passages where she has forgotten herself entirely.
"The robbers hid it," she says.
"Hid the money," Jerome says. "The 20,000.
"And the notebooks. Pete found at least some of them, maybe even all of them. He used the money to help his folks. He didn't get in trouble until he tried selling the notebooks to help his sister. Halliday knows. By now, he may even have them. Hurry up, Bill. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up."
31. Morris lurches to the front of the store, heart pounding, temples thudding. He drops Andy's gun into his sport coat pocket, snatches up a book from one of the display tables, opens it, and slams it against his chin to staunch the blood. He could have wiped it with the sleeve of his coat, almost did, but he's thinking again now, and knows better. He'll have to go out in public, and he doesn't want to do that smeared with blood. The boy had some on his pants, though, and that's good. That's fine, in fact. I'm thinking again, and the boy better be thinking, too. If he is, I can still rescue the situation. He opens the shop door and looks both ways. No sign of Sauber's. He expected nothing else. Teenagers are fast. They're like cockroaches that way.
Moore scrambles in his pocket for the scrap of paper with Pete's cell phone number on it and suffers a moment of raw panic when he can't find it. At last his fingers touch something scrunched far down in one corner and he breathes a sigh of relief. His heart is pounding, pounding, and he slams one hand against his bony chest. "Don't you give up on me now," he thinks. "Don't you dare." He uses the shop's landline to call Salvers, because that also fits the story he's constructing in his mind. Morris thinks it's a good story. He doubts if John Rothstein could have told a better one.
32. When Pete comes fully back to himself, he's in a place Morris Bellamy knows well. Government Square, across from the Happy Cup Cafe. He sits on a bench to catch his breath, looking anxiously back the way he's come. He sees no sign of Red Lips, and this doesn't surprise him. Pete is also thinking again, and knows the man who tried to kill him would attract attention on the street. "I got him pretty good," Pete thinks grimly. Red Lips is now Bloody Chin. Good so far, but what now? As if in answer, his cell phone vibrates. Pete pulls it out of his pocket and looks at the number displayed. He recognizes the last four digits, 8877, from when he called Halliday and left a message about the weekend trip to Riverbend Resort. It has to be Red Lips. It sure can't be Mr. Halliday. This thought is so awful it makes him laugh, although the sound that comes out sounds more like a sob. His first impulse is to not answer. What changes his mind is something Red Lips said.
"Your house used to be my house. Isn't that an interesting coinky-dink?"
His mother's text instructed him to come home right after school. Tina's text said their mother knew about the money, so they're together at the house, waiting for him. Pete doesn't want to alarm them unnecessarily, especially when he's the cause for alarm, but he needs to know what this incoming call is about, especially since Dad isn't around to protect the two of them if the crazy guy should turn up on Sycamore Street. Dad's in Victor County, doing one of his show-and-tells. "I'll call the police," Pete thinks. When I tell him that, he'll head for the hills. He'll have to. This thought brings some marginal comfort, and he pushes accept.
"Hello, Peter," Red Lips says.
"I don't need to talk to you," Peter says. "You better run because I'm calling the cops."
"I'm glad I reached you before you did something so foolish. You won't believe this, but I'm telling you as a friend."
"You're right," Pete says. "I don't believe it. You tried to kill me."
"Here's something else you won't believe. I'm glad I didn't, because then I'd never find out where you hid the Rothstein notebooks."
"You never will," Pete says and adds. "I'm telling you as a friend." He's feeling a little steadier now. Red Lips isn't chasing him. And he isn't on his way to Sycamore Street either. He's hiding in the bookshop and talking on the landline.
"That's what you think now because you haven't considered the long view. I have. Here's the situation. You went to Andy to sell the notebooks. He tried to blackmail you instead, so you killed him."
Pete says nothing. He can't. He's flabbergasted.
"Peter? Are you there? If you don't want to spend a year in the Riverview Youth Detention Center followed by 20 or so in Waynesville, you better be. I've been in both, and I can tell you they're no place for young men with virgin bottoms. College would be much better, don't you think?"
"I wasn't even in the city last weekend," Pete says. "I was at a school retreat. I can prove it." Red Lips doesn't hesitate.
"Then you did it before you left. Or possibly on Sunday night after you got back. The police are going to find your voicemail. I was sure to save it. There's also DVD security footage of you arguing with him. I took the discs, but I'll be sure the police get them if we can't come to an agreement. Then there's the fingerprints. They'll find yours on the doorknob of his inner office. Better still, they'll find them on the murder weapon. I think you're in a box. Even if you can account for every minute of your time this past weekend."
Pete realizes with dismay that he can't even do that.
He missed everything on Sunday. He remembers Ms. Bran, alias Bran Stoker, standing by the door of the bus just 24 hours ago, cell phone in hand, ready to call 911 and report a missing student. "I'm sorry," he told her. "I was sick to my stomach. I thought the fresh air would help me. I was vomiting." He can see her in court, all too clearly saying that yes, Peter did look sick that afternoon, and he can hear the prosecuting attorney telling the jury that any teenage boy probably would look sick after chopping an elderly book dealer into kindling with a hatchet. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I submit to you that Pete Sauber's hitchhiked back to the city that Sunday morning because he had an appointment with Mr. Halliday, who thought Mr. Sauber's had finally decided to give in to his blackmail demands. Only Mr. Sauber's had no intention of giving in. It's a nightmare," Pete thinks. "Like dealing with Halliday all over again, only 1,000 times worse." "Peter, are you there?" "No one would believe it. Not for a second. Not once they find out about you."
"And who am I, exactly?" "The wolf," Pete thinks. "You're the big bad wolf. People must have seen him that Sunday wandering around the resort acreage. Plenty of people, because he'd mostly stuck to the paths. Some would surely remember him and come forward, but as Red Lips said, that left before the trip and after, especially Sunday night when he'd gone straight to his room and closed the door. On CSI and Criminal Minds, police scientists were always able to figure out the exact time of a murdered person's death, but in real life, who knew? Not Pete. And if the police had a good suspect, one whose prints were on the murder weapon, the time of death might become negotiable. But I had to throw the hatchet at him," he thinks. "It was all I had." Believing that things can get no worse, Pete looks down and sees a blood stain on his knee. Mr. Halliday's blood.
"I can fix this," Red Lips says smoothly. "And if we come to terms, I will. I can wipe your fingerprints. I can erase the voicemail. I can destroy the security DVDs. All you have to do is tell me where the notebooks are."
"Like I should trust you."
"You should."
Low, coaxing and unreasonable.
"Think about it, Peter. With you out of the picture, Andy's murder looks like an attempted robbery gone wrong. The work of some random crackhead or meth freak. That's good for both of us. With you in the picture, the existence of the notebooks comes out. Why would I want that?"
"You won't care," Pete thinks. "You won't have to because you won't be anywhere near here when Halliday is discovered dead in his office. You said you were in Waynesville, and that makes you an ex-con, and you knew Mr. Halliday. Put those together and you'd be a suspect too. Your fingerprints are in there as well as mine, and I don't think you can wipe them all up. What you can do, if I let you, is take the notebooks and go. And once you're gone, what's to keep you from sending the police those security DVDs just for spite? To get back at me for hitting you with that liquor bottle and then getting away. If I agree to what you're saying..." He finishes the thought aloud. "I'll only look worse no matter what you say."
"I assure you that's not true."
He sounds like a lawyer. One of the sleazy ones with fancy hair who advertise on the cable channels late at night. Pete's outrage returns and straightens him on the bench like an electric shock. "Fuck you! You're never getting those notebooks." He ends the call. The phone buzzes in his hand almost immediately, same number. Red Lips calling back. Pete hits decline and turns the phone off. Right now he needs to think harder and smarter than ever in his life. Mom and Tina, they're the most important thing. He has to talk to Mom, tell her that she and teens have to get out of the house right away, go to a motel or something. They have to... No, not Mom. It's his sister he has to talk to, at least to begin with. He didn't take that Mr. Hodges card, but Tina must know how to get in touch with him. If that doesn't work, he'll have to call the police and take his chances. He will not put his family at risk, no matter what. Pete speed dials his sister.
33. Hello? Peter? Hello? Hello? Nothing. The thieving son of a bitch is hung up. Morris's first impulse is to rip the desk phone out of the wall and throw it at one of the bookcases, but he restrains himself at the last moment. This is no time to lose himself in a rage. So what now? What next? Is Sauber's going to call the police despite all the evidence stacked against him? Morris can't allow himself to believe that, because if he does, the notebooks will be lost to him. And consider this. Would the boy take such an irrevocable step without talking to his parents first? Without asking their advice? Without warning them? I have to move fast, Morris thinks, and aloud, as he wipes his fingerprints off the phone. If 'twere to be done, best it be done quickly. And 'twere best he wash his face and leave by the back door. He doesn't believe the gunshots were heard on the street. The inner office must be damn near soundproof, lined with books as it is, but he doesn't want to take the risk. He scrubs away the blood goatee in Halliday's bathroom, careful to leave the red-stained washcloth in the sink where the police will find it when they eventually turn up. With that done, he follows a narrow aisle to a door with an exit sign above it and boxes of books stacked in front of it. He moves them, thinking how stupid to block the fire exit that way. Stupid and short-sighted. That could be my old pal's epitaph, Morris thinks. Here lies Andrew Halliday, a fat, stupid, short-sighted homo. He will not be missed. The heat of late afternoon whacks him like a hammer, and he staggers. His head is thumping from being hit with that goddamn decanter, but the brains inside are in high gear. He gets in the Subaru, where it's even hotter, and turns the air conditioning to max as soon as he starts the engine. He examines himself in the rearview mirror. There's an ugly purple bruise surrounding a crescent-shaped cut on his chin, but the bleeding has stopped, and on the whole, he doesn't look too bad. He wishes he had some aspirin, but that can wait. He backs out of Andy's space and threads his way down the alley leading to Grant Street. Grant is more down market than Lacemaker Lane with its fancy shops, but at least cars are allowed there. As Morris stops at the mouth of the alley, Hodges and his two partners arrive on the other side of the building and stand looking at the closed sign hanging in the door of Andrew Halliday Rare Editions. A break in the Grant Street traffic comes just as Hodges is trying the bookshop door and finding it unlocked. Morris makes a quick left and heads toward the crosstown connector. With rush hour only getting started, he can be on the north side in 15 minutes, maybe 12. He needs to keep Saubers from going to the police, assuming he hasn't already, and there's one sure way to do that. All he has to do is beat the notebook thief to his little sister.
34. Behind the Saubers' house, near the fence that separates the family's backyard from the undeveloped land, there's a rusty old swing set that Tom Saubers keeps meaning to take down now that both of his children are too old for it. This afternoon, Tina is sitting on the glider, rocking slowly back and forth. Divergent is open in her lap, but she hasn't turned a page in the last 5 minutes. Mom has promised to watch the movie with her as soon as she's finished the book, but today Tina doesn't want to read about teenagers in the ruins of Chicago. Today that seems awful instead of romantic. Still moving slowly back and forth, she closes both the book and her eyes. God, she prays, please don't let Pete be in really bad trouble, and don't let him hate me. I'll die if he hates me, so please let him understand why I told. Please. God gets right back to her. God says Pete won't blame her because Mom figured it out on her own, but Tina's not sure she believes him. She opens the book again but still can't read. The day seems to hang suspended, waiting for something awful to happen. The cell phone she got for her 11th birthday is upstairs in her bedroom. It's just a cheapie, not the iPhone with all the bells and whistles she desired. But it's her most prized possession, and she's rarely without it. Only this afternoon, she is. She left it in her room and went out to the backyard as soon as she texted Pete. She had to send that text. She couldn't just let him walk in unprepared, but she can't bear the thought of an angry, accusatory callback. She'll have to face him in a little while. That can't be avoided. But Mom will be with her then. Mom will tell him it wasn't Tina's fault, and he'll believe her.
Probably.
Now the cell begins to vibrate and jiggle on her desk. She's got a cool Snow Patrol ringtone, but sick to her stomach and worried about Pete. Tina never thought to switch it from the mandated school setting when she and her mother got home, so Linda Saubers doesn't hear it downstairs. The screen lights up with her brother's picture. Eventually, the phone falls silent. After 30 seconds or so, it starts vibrating again, and a third time. Then it quits for good. Pete's picture disappears from the screen. 35. In Government Square, Pete stares at his phone incredulously. For the first time in his memory, Teens has failed to answer her cell while school is not in session. Mom, then. Or maybe not. Not quite yet. She'll want to ask a billion questions and time is tight. Also, although he won't quite admit this to himself, he doesn't want to talk to her until he absolutely has to. He uses Google to troll for Mr. Hodges' number. He finds 9 William Hodges here in the city, but the one he wants has got to be Kay William, who has a company called Finders Keepers. Pete calls and gets an answering machine. At the end of the message, which seems to last at least an hour, Holly says, "If you need immediate assistance, you may dial 555-1890. Pete once more debates calling his mother, then decides to go with the number the recording has given him first. What convinces him are 2 words: immediate assistance. 36.
Oof,
Holly says as they approach the empty service desk in the middle of Andrew Halliday's narrow shop.
What's that smell?
Blood, Hodges replies. It's also decaying meat, but he doesn't want to say that. You stay here, both of you.
Are you carrying a weapon? Jerome asks.
I've got the slapper.
That's all?
Hodges shrugs.
Then I'm coming with you.
Me too,
Holly says, and grabs a substantial book called Wild Plants and Flowering Herbs of North America. She holds it as if she means to swat a stinging bug.
No, Hodges says patiently. You're going to stay right here, both of you, and race to see which one can dial 911 first if I yell for you to do so.
Bill?
Jerome begins. Don't argue with me, Jerome, and don't waste time. I've got an idea time might be rather short.
A hunch?
Holly asks. Maybe a little more. Hodges takes the happy slapper from his coat pocket. These days he's rarely without it, although he seldom carries his old service weapon, and grasps it above the knot. He advances quickly and quietly to the door of what he assumes is Andrew Halliday's private office. It's standing slightly ajar. The slapper's loaded in, swings from his right hand. He stands slightly to one side of the door and knocks with his left. Because this seems to be one of those moments when the strict truth is dispensable, he calls, "It's the police, Mr. Halliday." There's no answer. He knocks again louder, and when there's still no answer, he pushes the door open. The smell is instantly stronger. Blood, decay, and spilled booze. Something else, too. Spent gunpowder, an aroma he knows well. Flies are buzzing somnolently. The lights are on, seeming to spotlight the body on the floor.
Oh, Christ, his head's half off, Jerome cries.
He's so close that Hodges jerks in surprise, bringing the slapper up and then lowering it again. My pacemaker just went into overdrive, he thinks. He turns, and both of them are crowding up right behind him. Jerome has a hand over his mouth. His eyes are bulging. Holly, on the other hand, looks calm. She's got Wild Plants and Flowering Herbs of North America clasped against her chest and appears to be assessing the bleeding mess on the rug. To Jerome, she says,
"Don't hurl. This is a crime scene."
"I'm not going to hurl."
The words are muffled thanks to the hand clutching his lower face. "Neither one of you minds worth a tinker's dam," Hodges says. "If I were your teacher, I'd send you both to the office."
I'm going in. You two stand right where you are. He takes two steps in. Jerome and Holly immediately follow side by side. The fucking Bobbsey twins, Hodges thinks.
Did Tina's brother do this?
Jerome asks.
Jesus Christ, Bill, did he?
If he did, it wasn't today. That blood's almost dry, and there's the flies. I don't see any maggots yet, but...
Jerome makes a gagging noise.
Jerome, don't,
Holly says in a forbidding voice. Then to Hodges.
I see a little axe. Hatchet. Whatever you call it. That's what did it.
Hodges doesn't reply. He's assessing the scene. He thinks that Halliday, if it is Halliday, has been dead at least 24 hours, maybe longer. Probably longer. But something has happened in here since, because the smell of spilled liquor and gunpowder is fresh and strong.
Is that a bullet hole, Bill?
Jerome asks. He's pointing at a bookshelf to the left of the door near a small cherrywood table. There's a small round hole in a copy of Catch-22. Hodges goes to it, looks more closely, and thinks, that's got to hurt the resale price. Then he looks at the table. There are two crystal decanters on it, probably Waterford. The table is slightly dusty, and he can see the shapes where two others stood. He looks across the room beyond the desk, and yep, there they are, lying on the floor.
Sure it's a bullet hole, Holly says. I can smell the gunpowder.
There was a fight, Jerome says, then points to the corpse without looking at it.
But he sure wasn't part of it.
No, Hodges says, not him. And the combatants have since departed.
Was one of them Peter Saubers?
Hodges sighs heavily. Almost for sure. I think he came here after he ditched us at the drugstore.
Somebody took Mr. Halliday's computer, Holly says. His DVD hookup is still there beside the cash register, and the wireless mouse, also a little box with a few thumb drives in it. But the computer is gone. I saw a big empty space on the desk out there. It was probably a laptop.
What now? Jerome asks.
We call the police. Hodges doesn't want to do it. Senses that Pete Saubers is in bad trouble and calling the cops may only make it worse, at least to begin with. But he played the Lone Ranger in the Mercedes killer case and almost got a few thousand kids killed. He takes out his cell, but before he can turn it on, it lights up and rings in his hand.
Peter,
Holly says. Her eyes are shining, and she speaks with utter certainty.
Bet you $6,000. Now he wants to talk. Don't just stand there, Bill. Answer your fracking phone.
He does.
I need help, Pete Sauber says rapidly. Please, Mr. Hodges, I really need help.
Just a sec, I'm going to put you on speaker so my associates can hear.
Associates?
Pete sounds more alarmed than ever.
What associates?
Holly Gibney, your sister knows her. And Jerome Robinson, he's Barbara Robinson's older brother.
Oh, I guess that's okay.
And as if to himself,
how much worse can it get?
Peter, we're in Andrew Halliday's shop. There's a dead man in his office. I assume it's Halliday, and I assume you know about it. Would those assumptions be correct? There's a moment of silence. If not for the faint sound of traffic wherever Pete is, Hodges might have thought he'd broken the connection. Then the boy starts talking again, the words spilling out in a waterfall.
He was there when I got there, the man with the red lips. He told me Mr. Halliday was in the back, so I went into his office, and he followed me, and he had a gun, and he tried to kill me when I wouldn't tell him where the notebooks were. I wouldn't because he doesn't deserve to have them, and besides, he was going to kill me anyway. I could tell just by looking in his eyes.
You threw the decanters at him, didn't you?
Yes, the bottles, and he shot at me. He missed, but it was so close, I heard it go by. I ran and got away. But then he called me and said they'd blame me, the police would, because I threw a hatchet at him, too. Did you see the hatchet?
Yes, Hodges says. I'm looking at it right now.
And my fingerprints, see? They're on it because I threw it at him. And he has some video discs of me and Mr. Halliday arguing because he was trying to blackmail me. Halliday, I mean, not the man with the red lips, only now he's trying to blackmail me, too.
This red lips man has the store security video?
Holly asks, bending toward the phone.
Is that what you mean?
Yes. He said the police will arrest me, and they will, because I didn't go to any of the Sunday meetings at River Bend, and he also has a voicemail, and I don't know what to do.
Where are you, Peter? Hodges asks. Where are you right now? There's another pause, and Hodges knows exactly what Pete's doing, checking for landmarks. He may have lived in the city his whole life, but right now he's so freaked he doesn't know east from west.
Government Square, he says at last. Across from this restaurant, the Happy Cup?
Do you see the man who shot at you?
No. I ran, and I don't think he could chase me very far on foot. He's kind of old, and you can't drive a car on Lacemaker Lane.
Stay there, Hodges says. We'll come and get you.
Please don't call the police, Peter says. It'll kill my folks after everything else that's happened to them. I'll give you the notebooks. I never should have kept them, and I never should have tried to sell any of them. I should have stopped with the money.
His voice is blurring now as he breaks down.
My parents, they were in such trouble about everything. I only wanted to help.
I'm sure that's true, but I have to call the police. If you didn't kill Halliday, the evidence will show that. You'll be fine. I'll pick you up and we'll go to your house. Will your parents be there?
Dad's on a business thing, but my mom and sister will be.
Pete has to hitch in a breath before going on.
I'll go to jail, won't I? They'll never believe me about the man with the red lips. They'll think I made him up. All you have to do is tell the truth, Holly says. Bill won't let anything bad happen to you.
She grabs his hand and squeezes it fiercely.
Will you?
Hodges repeats. If you didn't kill him, you'll be fine.
I didn't. Swear to God.
This other man did. The one with the red lips.
Yes, he killed John Rothstein, too. He said Rothstein sold out.
Hodges has a million questions, but this isn't the time. Listen to me, Pete. Very carefully. Stay where you are. We'll be at Government Square in 15 minutes.
If you let me drive, Jerome says, we can be there in 10.
Hodges ignores this. The four of us will go to your house. You'll tell the whole story to me, my associates, and your mother. She may want to call your father and discuss getting you legal representation. Then we're going to call the police. It's the best I can do. And better than I should do, he thinks, eyeing the mangled corpse and thinking about how close he came to going to jail himself 4 years ago. For the same kind of thing, too. Lone Ranger shit. But surely another half hour or 45 minutes can't hurt, and what the boy said about his parents hit home. Hodges was at City Center that day. He saw the aftermath.
All right. Come as fast as you can.
Yes, he breaks the connection.
What do we do about our fingerprints?
Holly asks. Leave them, Hodges says. Let's go get that kid. I can't wait to hear his story. He tosses Jerome the Mercedes key.
Thanks, Master Hodges.
Tyrone Feelgood screeches.
This here black boy is one safe driver. I is gone get y'all safe to your dest.
Shut up, Jerome. Hodges and Holly say it together.
37. Pete takes a deep, trembling breath and closes his cell phone. Everything is going around in his head like some nightmare amusement park ride, and he's sure he sounded like an idiot or a murderer scared of getting caught and making up any wild tale. He forgot to tell Mr. Hodges that Red Lips once lived in Pete's own house, and he should have done that. He thinks about calling Hodges back, but why bother when he and those other two are coming to pick him up? The guy won't go to the house anyway, Pete tells himself. He can't. He has to stay invisible. But he might, just the same. If he thinks I was lying about moving the notebook somewhere else, he really might. Because he's crazy. A total whack job. He tries Tina's phone again and gets nothing but her message. Hey, it's Teen. Sorry I missed you. Do your thing. Beep. All right, then. Mom. But before he can call her, he sees a bus coming, and in the destination window, like a gift from heaven, are the words North Side. Pete suddenly decides he's not going to sit here and wait for Mr. Hodges. The bus will get him there sooner, and he wants to go home now. He'll call Mr. Hodges once he's on board and tell him to meet him at the house. But first he'll call his mother and tell her to lock all the doors. The bus is almost empty, but he makes his way to the back just the same. And he doesn't have to call his mother after all.
His phone rings in his hand as he sits down. "Mom," the screen says. He takes a deep breath and pushes accept. She's talking before he can even say hello.
"Where are you, Peter?"
Peter instead of Pete, not a good start.
"I expected you home an hour ago."
"I'm coming," he says. "I'm on the bus."
"Let's stick to the truth, shall we? The bus has come and gone. I saw it."
"Not the school bus, the North Side bus. I had to..." "What? Run an errand?" That's so ludicrous he could laugh. Except this is no laughing matter. Far from it.
"There was something I had to do. Is Tina there? She didn't go down to Ellen's or something?" "She's in the backyard reading her book."
The bus is picking its way past some road construction, moving with agonizing slowness. "Mom, listen to me. You..."
"No, you listen to me. Did you send that money?"
He closes his eyes.
"Did you? A simple yes or no will suffice. We can go into the details later."
Eyes still closed, he says. "Yes, it was me. But
where did it come from?"
"That's a long story, and right now it doesn't matter. The money doesn't matter. There's a guy..."
"What do you mean it doesn't matter? That was over $20,000.
He stifles an urge to say, "Did you just figure that out?" The bus continues lumbering its laborious way through the construction. Sweat is rolling down Pete's face. He can see the smear of blood on his knee, dark brown instead of red, but still as loud as a shout. "Guilty," it yells. "Guilty, guilty." "Mom, please shut up and listen to me." Shocked silence on the other end of the line. Not since the days of his toddler tantrums has he told his mother to shut up. "There's a guy and he's dangerous." He could tell her just how dangerous, but he wants her on alert, not in hysterics. "I don't think he'll come to the house, but he might. You should get Tina inside and lock the doors. Just for a few minutes, then I'll be there. Some other people, too, people who can help." "At least I hope so," he thinks. "God, I hope so." 38. Morris Bellamy turns onto Sycamore Street. He's aware that his life is rapidly narrowing to a point. All he has is a few hundred stolen dollars, a stolen car, and the need to get his hands on Rothstein's notebooks. Oh, he has one other thing, too. A short-term hideout where he can go and read and find out what happened to Jimmy Gold after the Does He Do campaign put him at the top of the advertising dung heap with a double fistful of those golden bucks. Morris understands this is a crazy goal, so he must be a crazy person, but it's all he has, and it's enough. There's his old house, which is now the notebook thief's house, with a little red car in the driveway. "Crazy don't mean shit," Morris Bellamy says. "Crazy don't mean shit. Nothing means shit. Words to live by."
39. "Bill," Jerome says, "I hate to say it, but I think our bird has flown."
Hodges looks up from his thoughts as Jerome guides the Mercedes through Government Square. There are quite a few people sitting on the benches, reading newspapers, chatting and drinking coffee, feeding the pigeons, but there are no teenagers of either sex.
"I don't see him at any of the tables on the cafe side either," Holly reports. "Maybe he went inside for a cup of coffee?"
"Right now, coffee would be the last thing on his mind," Hodges says. He pounds a fist on his thigh.
"North Side and South Side buses run through here every 15 minutes, Jerome says. "If I were in his shoes, sitting and waiting around for someone to come and pick me up would be torture. I'd want to be doing something."
That's when Hodges' phone rings.
"A bus came along and I decided not to wait," Pete says. He sounds calmer now. "I'll be home when you get there. I just got off the phone with my mother. She and Tina are okay."
Hodges doesn't like the sound of this. Why wouldn't they be, Peter?
"Because the guy with the red lips knows where we live. He said he used to live there. I forgot to tell you."
Hodges checks where they are. "How long to Sycamore Street, Jerome?"
"Be there in 20, maybe less. If I'd known the kid was going to grab a bus, I would have taken the crosstown."
"Mr. Hodges?"
"Pete, I'm here."
"He'd be stupid to go to my house anyway.
If he does that, I won't be framed anymore. He's got a point. Did you tell them to lock up and stay inside?
Yes.
And did you give your mom his description?
Yes.
Hodges knows that if he calls the cops, Mr. Red Lips will be gone with the wind, leaving Pete to depend on the forensic evidence to get him off the hook. And they can probably beat the cops anyway.
Tell him to call the guy,
Holly says. She leans toward Hodges and bellows,
call and say you changed your mind, and we'll give him the notebooks.
Pete, did you hear that?
Yeah, but I can't. I don't even know if he has a phone. He called me from the one in the bookshop. We didn't, you know, exactly have time to exchange info. How poopy is that?
Holly asks no one in particular. All right, call me the minute you get home and verify that everything's okay. If I don't hear from you, I'll have to call for the police.
I'm sure they're
But this is where they came in. Hodges closes his phone and leans forward. Punch it, Jerome.
As soon as I can.
He gestures at the traffic, three lanes going each way, chrome twinkling in the sunshine.
Once we get past the rotary up there, we'll be gone like Enron.
20 minutes, Hodges thinks. 20 minutes at most. What can happen in 20 minutes? The answer, he knows from bitter experience, is quite a lot. Life and death. Right now, all he can do is hope those 20 minutes don't come back to haunt him.
40. Linda Salbers came into her husband's little home office to wait for Pete, because her husband's laptop is on the desk and she can play computer solitaire. She is far too upset to read. After talking to Pete, she's more upset than ever. Afraid, too, but not of some sinister villain lurking on Sycamore Street. She's afraid for her son, because it's clear he believes in the sinister villain. Things are finally starting to come together. His pallor and weight loss, the crazy mustache he tried to grow, the return of his acne and his long silences, they all make sense now. If he's not having a nervous breakdown, he's on the verge of one. She gets up and looks out the window at her daughter. Tina's got her best blouse on, the billowy yellow one, and no way should she be wearing it on a dirty old glider that should have been taken down years ago. She has a book, and it's open, but she doesn't seem to be reading. She looks drawn and sad. What a nightmare, Linda thinks. First Tom hurt so badly he'll walk with a limp for the rest of his life, and now our son's seeing monsters in the shadows. That money wasn't manna from heaven, it was acid rain. Maybe he just has to come clean. Tell us the whole story about where the money came from. Once he does that, the healing process can begin. In the meantime, she'll do as he asked. Call Tina inside and lock the house. It can't hurt. A board creaks behind her. She turns, expecting to see her son, but it's not Pete. It's a man with pale skin, thinning white hair, and red lips. It's the man her son described, the sinister villain. And her first feeling isn't terror, but an absurdly powerful sense of relief. Her son isn't having a nervous breakdown after all. Then she sees the gun in the man's hand, and the terror comes, bright and hot.
You must be Mom, the intruder says. Strong family resemblance.
Who are you? Linda Salbers asks. What are you doing here? The intruder, in the doorway of her husband's study instead of in her son's mind, glances out the window, and Linda has to suppress an urge to say, don't look at her.
Is that your daughter? Morris asks.
Hey, she's pretty. I always liked the girl in yellow. What do you want? Linda asks.
What's mine? Morris says, and shoots her in the head.
Blood flies up and spatters red droplets against the glass. It sounds like rain.
41. Tina hears an alarming bang from the house and runs for the kitchen door. It's the pressure cooker, she thinks. Mom forgot the damn pressure cooker again. This has happened once before while her mother was making preserves. It's an old cooker, the kind that sits on the stove, and Pete spent most of one Saturday afternoon on a stepladder scraping dried strawberry goo off the ceiling. Mom was vacuuming the living room when it happened, which was lucky. Tina hopes to God she wasn't in the kitchen this time either. Mom?
She runs inside. There's nothing on the stove.
Ma...
An arm grabs her around the middle hard. Tina loses her breath in an explosive whoosh. Her feet rise from the floor, kicking. She can feel whiskers against her cheek. She can smell sweat, sour and hot.
Don't scream, and I won't have to hurt you,
the man says into her ear, making her skin prickle.
Do you understand?
Tina manages to nod, but her heart is hammering and the world is going dark.
Let me breathe,
she gasps, and the hold loosens. Her feet go back to the floor. She turns and sees a man with a pale face and red lips. There's a cut on his chin. It looks like a bad one. The skin around it is swollen and blue-black.
Don't scream, he repeats and raises an admonitory finger. Do not do that. He smiles, and if it's supposed to make her feel better, it doesn't work.
His teeth are yellow. They look more like fangs than teeth.
What did you do to my mother?
She's fine, the man with the red lips says. Where's your cell phone? A pretty little girl like you must have a cell phone. Lots of friends to chatter and text with. Is it in your pocket?
No. Upstairs in my room.
Let's go get it, Morris says. You're going to make a call.
42. Pete's stop is Elm Street, two blocks over from the house, and the bus is almost there. He's making his way to the front when his cell buzzes. His relief at seeing his sister's smiling face in the little window is so great that his knees loosen and he has to grab one of the strap handles. Tina, I'll be there in a...
There's a man here.
Tina is crying so hard he can barely understand her.
He was in the house. He...
Then she's gone, and he knows the voice that replaces hers. He wishes to God he didn't.
Hello, Peter, Red Lips says. Are you on your way?
He can't say anything. His tongue is stuck to the roof of his mouth. The bus pulls over at the corner of Elm and Breckenridge Terrace, his stop, but Pete only stands there.
Don't bother answering that, and don't bother coming home because no one will be here if you do.
He's lying,
Tina yells. Mom is... Then she howls.
Don't you hurt her,
Pete says. The few other riders don't look around from their papers or handhelds because he can't speak above a whisper.
Don't you hurt my sister.
I won't if she shuts up. She needs to be quiet. You need to be quiet too and listen to me. But first you need to answer two questions. Have you called the police?
No.
Have you called anyone?
No.
Pete lies without hesitation.
Good. Excellent. Now comes the listening part. Are you listening?
A large lady with a shopping bag is clambering onto the bus, wheezing. Pete gets off as soon as she's out of the way, walking like a boy in a dream, the phone plastered to his ear.
I'm taking your sister with me to a safe place. A place where we can meet once you have the notebooks.
Pete starts to tell him they don't have to do it that way. He'll just tell Red Lips where the notebooks are, then realizes doing that would be a huge mistake. Once Red Lips knows they're in the basement at the wreck, he'll have no reason to keep Tina alive.
Are you there, Peter?
Yes.
You better be. You just better be. Get the notebooks. When you have them, and not before, call your sister's cell again. If you call for any other reason, I'll hurt her.
Is my mother all right?
She's fine, just tied up. Don't worry about her and don't bother going home. Just get the notebooks and call me.
With that, Red Lips is gone. Pete doesn't have time to tell him he has to go home because he'll need Tina's wagon again to haul the cartons. He also needs to get his father's key to the wreck. He returned it to the board in his father's office and he needs it to get in. 43. Morris slips Tina's pink phone into his pocket and yanks a cord from her desktop computer. Turn around, hands behind you.
Did you shoot her?
Tears are running down Tina's cheeks.
Was that the sound I heard? Did you shoot my mother?
Morris slaps her and hard.
Blood flies from Tina's nose in the corner of her mouth. Her eyes widen in shock. You need to shut your quack and turn around, hands behind you. Tina does it, sobbing. Morris ties her wrists together at the small of her back, cinching the knots viciously.
Ow! Ow! Mister, that's too tight!
Deal with it. He wonders vaguely how many shots might be left in his old pal's gun. Two will be enough, one for the thief and one for the thief's sister. Walk. Downstairs, out the kitchen door. Let's go. Up, two, three, four. She looks back at him, her eyes huge and bloodshot and swimming with tears.
Are you going to rape me?
No, Mora says, then adds something that is all the more terrifying because she doesn't understand it. I won't make that mistake again.
44. Linda comes to staring at the ceiling. She knows where she is, Tom's office, but not what has happened to her. The right side of her head is on fire, and when she raises a hand to her face, it comes away wet with blood. The last thing she can remember is Peggy Moran telling her that Tina had gotten sick at school. Go get her and take her home, Peggy had said. I'll cover this. No. She remembers something else. Something about the mystery money. I was going to talk to Pete about it, she thinks. Get some answers. I was playing solitaire on Tom's computer, just killing time while I waited for him to come home, and then black. Now, this terrible pain in her head, like a constantly slamming door. It's even worse than the migraines she sometimes gets. Worse even than childbirth. She tries to raise her head and manages to do it, but the world starts going in and out with her heartbeat, first sucking, then blooming, each oscillation accompanied by such god-awful agony. She looks down and sees the front of her gray dress has changed to a muddy purple. She thinks, oh God, that's a lot of blood. Have I had a stroke? Some kind of brain hemorrhage? Surely not. Surely those only bleed on the inside. But whatever it is, she needs help. She needs an ambulance, but she can't make her hand go to the phone. It lifts, trembles, and drops back to the floor. She hears a yelp of pain from somewhere close, then crying she'd recognize anywhere, even while dying, which she suspects she may be. It's Tina. She manages to prop herself up on one bloody hand enough to look out the window. She sees a man hustling Tina down the back steps into the yard. Tina's hands are tied behind her. Linda forgets about her pain, forgets about needing an ambulance. A man has broken in, and he's now abducting her daughter. She needs to stop him. She needs the police. She tries to get into the swivel chair behind the desk, but at first she can only paw at the seat. She does a lunging sit-up, and for a moment the pain is so intense the world turns white. But she holds on to consciousness and grabs the arms of the chair. When her vision clears, she sees the man opening the back gate and shoving Tina through, herding her like an animal on its way to the slaughterhouse.
Bring her back! Linda screams, don't you hurt my baby.
But only in her head. When she tries to get up, the chair turns and she loses her grip on the arms. The world darkens.
She hears a terrible gagging sound before she blacks out and has time to think, can that be me?
45. Things are not golden after the rotary. Instead of open street, they see backed up traffic and two orange signs. One says, Flagger ahead. The other says, Road construction. There's a line of cars waiting while the flagger lets downtown traffic go through. After 3 minutes of sitting, each one feeling an hour long, Hodges tells Jerome to use the side streets.
I wish I could, but we're blocked in.
He jerks a thumb over his shoulder where the line of cars behind them is now backed up almost to the rotary. Holly has been bent over her iPad, whacking away. Now she looks up.
Use the sidewalk, she says,
then goes back to her magic tablet.
There are mailboxes, Holly Berry, Jerome says. Also a chain-link fence up ahead. I don't think there's room.
She takes another brief look.
Yeah, there is. You may scrape a little, but it won't be the first time for this car. Go on.
Who pays the fine if I get arrested on a charge of driving while black? You?
Holly rolls her eyes. Jerome turns to Hodges, who sighs and nods. She's right. There's room. I'll pay your fucking fine. Jerome swings right. The Mercedes clips the fender of the car stopped ahead of them, then bumps up onto the sidewalk. Here comes the first mailbox. Jerome swings even farther to the right, now entirely off the street. There's a thud as the driver's side knocks the mailbox off its post, then a drawn-out squall as the passenger side caresses the chain-link fence. A woman in shorts and a halter top is mowing her lawn. She shouts at them as the passenger side of Holly's German U-boat peels away a sign reading, "No trespassing, no soliciting, no door-to-door salesman." She rushes for her driveway, still shouting. Then she just peers, shading her eyes and squinting. Hodges can see her lips moving.
Oh, goody, Jerome says. She's getting your plate number.
Just drive, Holly says. Drive, drive, drive.
And with no pause.
Red Lips is Morris Bellamy. That's his name.
It's the flagger yelling at them now. The construction workers who have been uncovering a sewer pipe running beneath the street are staring. Some are laughing. One of them winks at Jerome and makes a bottle-tipping gesture. Then they are passed. The Mercedes thumps back down to the street. With traffic bound for the north side bottleneck behind them, the street ahead is blessedly empty.
I checked the city tax records, Holly says. At the time John Rothstein was murdered, in 1978, the taxes on 23 Sycamore Street were being paid by Anita Elaine Bellamy. I did a Google search for her name and came up with over 50 hits. She's sort of a famous academic, but only one hit that matters. Her son was tried and convicted of aggravated rape late that same year, right here in the city. He got a life sentence. There's a picture of him in one of the news stories. Look.
She hands the iPad to Hodges. Morris Bellamy has been snapped coming down the steps of a courthouse Hodges remembers well, although it was replaced by the concrete monstrosity in Government Square 15 years ago. Bellamy is flanked by a pair of detectives. Hodges recalls one of them, Paul Emerson. Good police, long retired. He's wearing a suit. So is the other detective, but that one has draped his coat over Bellamy's hands to hide the handcuffs he's wearing. Bellamy is also in a suit, which means the picture was taken either while the trial was ongoing or just after the verdict was rendered. It's a black and white photo which only makes the contrast between Bellamy's pale complexion and dark mouth more striking. He almost looks like he's wearing lipstick.
That's got to be him, Holly says. If you call the state prison, I'll bet you $6,000 that he's out.
No bet, Hodges says. How long to Sycamore Street, Jerome?
10 minutes.
Firm or optimistic? Reluctantly, Jerome replies, well, maybe a tad optimistic. Just do the best you can and try not to run anybody over. Hodges' cell rings. It's Pete. He sounds out of breath.
Have you called the police, Mr. Hodges?
No. Although they'll probably have the license plate of Holly's car by now, but he sees no reason to tell Pete that. The boy sounds more upset than ever, almost crazed.
You can't, no matter what. He's got my sister. He says if he doesn't get the notebooks, he'll kill her. I'm going to give them to him.
Pete, don't. But he's talking to no one. Pete has broken the connection.
46. Morris hustles Tina along the path. At one point, a jutting branch rips her filmy blouse and scratches her arm, bringing blood.
Don't make me go so fast, mister. I'll fall down.
Morris whacks the back of her head above her ponytail. Save your breath, bitch. Just be grateful I'm not making you run. He holds on to her shoulders as they cross the stream, balancing her so she won't fall in. And when they reach the point where the scrub brush and stunted trees give way to the wrecked property, he tells her to stop. The baseball field is deserted, but a few boys are on the cracked asphalt of the basketball court. They're stripped to the waist, their shoulders gleaming. The day is really too hot for outside games, which is why Morris supposes there are only a few of them. He unties Tina's hands. She gives a little whimper of relief and starts rubbing her wrists, which are crisscrossed with deep red grooves. "We're going to walk along the edge of the trees," he tells her. "The only time those boys will be able to get a good look at us is when we get near the building and come out of the shade. If they say hello, or if there's someone you know, just wave and smile and keep walking. Do you understand?"
Yes.
"If you scream or yell for help, I'll put a bullet in your head. Do you understand that?"
"Yes. Did you shoot my mother? You did, didn't you?"
"Of course not. Just fired one into the ceiling to settle her down. She's fine, and you will be too if you do as you're told. Get moving." They walk in the shade, the uncut grass of right field wickering against Morris's trousers and Tina's jeans. The boys are totally absorbed in their game and don't even look around, although if they had, Tina's bright yellow blouse would have stood out against the green trees like a warning flag. When they reach the back of the wreck, Morris guides her past his old pal Subaru, keeping a close eye on the boys as he does so. Once the brick flank of the building hides the two of them from the basketball court, he ties Tina's hands behind her again. No sense taking chances with Birch Street so close. Lots of houses on Birch Street. He sees Tina draw in a deep breath and grabs her shoulder. "Don't yell, girlfriend. Open your mouth and I'll beat it off you."
"Please don't hurt me,"
Tina whispers.
"I'll do whatever you want."
Morris nods, satisfied. It's a wise con response if he ever heard one. "See that basement window? The one that's open? Lie down, turn over on your belly, and drop through." Tina squats and peers into the shadows. Then she turns her bloody swollen face up to him.
"It's too far, I'll fall."
Exasperated, Morris kicks her in the shoulder. She cries out. He bends over and places the muzzle of the automatic against her temple. "You said you'd do whatever I wanted, and that's what I want. Get through that window right now, or I'll put a bullet in your tiny brat brain." Morris wonders if he means it. He decides he does. Little girls also don't mean shit. Weeping, Tina squirms through the window. She hesitates, half in and half out, looking at Morris with pleading eyes. He draws his foot back to kick her in the face and help her along. She drops, then yells in spite of Morris's explicit instructions not to.
"My ankle! I think I broke my ankle!"
Morris doesn't give a fuck about her ankle. He takes a quick look around to make sure he's still unobserved, then slides through the window and into the basement of the Birch Street wreck, landing on the closed carton he used for a step last time. The thief's sister must have landed on it wrong and tumbled to the floor. Her foot is twisted sideways and already beginning to swell. To Morris Bellamy, that doesn't mean shit either.